Welcome to Power of the Tribe podcast. I'm your host, John Connors. I'm also the founder and head instructor of Connors Martial Arts in Norwood, Massachusetts. We teach Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which is amazing martial art, Muay Thai kickboxing, the martial art of Thailand, and mixed martial arts. And I'm here with Dan Robin. How you doing, Dan?
I'm good. So happy New Year episode.
A happy New Year. It's January 3rd, 2020. Pretty crazy, right?
Yeah. How's your year going so far?
So far, pretty good. I got on the scale today. I'm about 5.5 pounds above my competition training weight. Not horrible, right?
Yeah. I'm avoiding the scale.
You're avoiding the scale.
I'm going to wait till probably like Friday.
You were up in the mountains.
Yeah, but it was a disgusting 2 weeks. You know, like I didn't, there was a solid week of me not working out and a
right.
solid 2 weeks of just total lack of any sort of healthy, you know, just eating cookies.
Well, I had the head split open, so I didn't train for about a week. And then Dimitri, I was texting him. I thought he ghosted me. I thought Dan, the man who gets ghosted, was flipping the script and ghosting me, but he was,
I was
out of range.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good place to go where you're out of range,
yeah, away
right?
from humanity. That's what I love about it up there.
Yeah.
I love to go up. I've told you this. I go up. This was with my family, but often I go up with just my dog or dogs. And then I just like complete hermit, complete recluse up there with my
with
dogs.
With your dogs. That's pretty cool,
yeah.
right?
Especially then if your phone's not working, you don't get on the internet. You're just like, you're
what is it about dogs, Dan, when I used to have a bloodhound named Yogi who was an amazing dog. Probably a dog you would like. He was 100 pounds and just like awesome. And before I got him, I was fantasizing about being in the woods with my dog. And I don't know. There's something about that that's in the human genome or something, right?
Maybe. I think it's a good way of being by yourself and away from everybody, but not totally lonely. Like, you know,
right.
not totally
right.
there with no one like you can talk to the dog.
Or you get a trusted companion.
Some interaction.
Yeah.
There's some interaction.
The dog is on your side no matter what.
It's like interaction and company with no judgment or worrying what you said at all. Not that you worry. Not that I worry almost ever about what I'm saying, but it's still different. You know, to just be away from everyone.
I don't know if you recall, before the Boston Open, I came across a book by this guy, Tom Bunn, and it was like the 10-day program to be panic-free or anxiety-free. And one of the methods was to imagine your dog looking you in the face and wagging his tail. And apparently that simulates oxytocin in us, which is like, I think that's a vagal breaking thing or something where it's hard to have a stress response when your dog is by your side and is happy to see you.
I think it probably works. I can remember one from 25 years ago when I was moving to a ballpark somewhere on there where I was moving to Indiana, and it was sort of a uprooting of everything. You know what I mean? Everything got thrown in
that's
a van.
That's stressful.
And it was just, I was moving out to Indiana, and you know, I didn't know anything about Indiana. I didn't even really understand what I was going to.
I know basketball and Larry Bird. That's it.
And
you know anything else about Indiana? I don't know.
Well, Bobby Knight.
Bobby Knight.
He was there.
Right.
I was going to Indiana University.
Right.
But I didn't even understand really like what sort of research I was, but you know, it was really kind of vague about, I wasn't positive where I was going to live. The whole thing was kind of a mess. And, but my dog was with me in the moving van.
Oh, wow.
And like, I would just feel like, I just sort of pet the dog and he was real steady too. He would just sort of look at me and I'd be
nice.
Like, it's all right, pup, you know, give him a pat. And
what was his name?
Zach.
Zach. That's a good
now,
name.
It was
a strong name.
At the time, it was a dog name. Now, since that time, it became like every kid's been named Zach.
Oh, right. What breed was he?
It's called a Bouvier.
Oh, yeah. I know the Bouvier.
You've heard of him.
Oh,
most
yeah.
people don't. Bouvier de Flanders.
Bouvier de Flanders, yep.
So people hear it, and it sounds French, so they think like a French poodle or lap dog, but they're not.
They're powerful built dogs, kind of stocky. My memory of the ones that I've seen, very quiet, almost stoic dog.
Completely accurate, yeah.
Very cool dog, yeah.
Just kind of follows you around, quiet, cool.
I read an article about the Bouvier de Flanders in Sports Illustrated, of all places.
Yeah, I know
like, you know the article?
Yeah, because I had a Bouvier. So.
This is like in the 70s, Dan.
Yeah.
The article came out like 1975 or something.
I know the article, though.
And in the article, they said the Bouvier de Flanders has the strongest bite per square inch or something than any other canine. So, and the guy in the article, they were sort of guard dogs or something. Yeah. The guy was training. So my dad came home one, like right around the same time. And he goes, yeah, my buddy at work, he's got a German Shepherd. And they have the strongest bite of any dog. So that's what he's, and I go, oh, yeah? And I whipped out the Sports Illustrated. I think my dad took it in to debunk this other guy. And they're probably both wrong, right?
I think they're probably both wrong.
It's like some kind of pit bull or something,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, something with a bigger head. Bull Mastiff.
Like, Bull Mastiff,
you know,
got to be
gonna
it,
match
right?
that when you're a German Shepherd with that little narrow face.
Right.
I don't want to get bit by any of them.
No.
But my Bouvier had big werewolf teeth. I remember I could pull his lips back and his teeth were just humongous.
They're almost like a gigantic Scottish Terrier on steroids or something, right? Yeah.
Yeah, but anyway, he was so calm.
Yeah.
Like you just feel like he'd be like, it's fine. We're going to Indiana. And also, I think there's something about your role with the dog is to calm them down, like to be the alpha. So it's sort of like it puts you in that mindset of like not being nervous and not being because you're like in charge, you know.
Now, your dog guy, I know that. Do you ever have you must have watched The Dog Whisperer, that show?
Yes.
So my take on that show, Dan, as I've watched many episodes, is essentially the answer to every dog situation is the dog needs more exercise and the owner needs to act like the alpha.
Yeah, that's pretty much his whole thing.
That's the whole thing, right?
Yeah, it's interesting to me to watch these dog trainers. So,
but do you believe that's a valid theory? To be a fundamental theory.
I think there's more specifics to it than that. But like, there's a couple. So a couple.
But if you got that wrong, nothing else is going to work. So if you have a dog and it's not getting proper exercise, doesn't matter what training you're giving it, right?
No,
it's going to lose its mind.
I think it all depends on the dog is the thing, right? Like there's probably
the amount of
exercise. Dogs.
Well, that's it. Well, the amount of exercise per dog is going to vary.
Right.
But I'm saying if the dog isn't getting proper movement, it's like a human being. Like you're not going to be good, right?
Right.
Yeah.
You think that probably applies to a lot of human beings, right?
Yeah.
But I also think for the dog whisperer, a lot of people forget, like, if you have a problem with the dog, like, then you need to be alpha. But sometimes people have dogs that are not a problem. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, so, for example, he'd always be like, don't let the dog go out the door before you.
Before you. Yep.
But like,
which is very hard to
but
do, right?
But I let the dog go out before me, like, because I didn't have a problem with, like, you know what I mean? Like, I had a, it was, I,
the dog knew you were the alpha.
Yeah. It was fine. So he could go out the door before me. You know, so there's a lot of things people follow and it's like, but not everyone needs to do that. Not everyone needs to follow that. But there's a funny backlash because you and I have talked a lot about this before, how the world seems split now into sort of two camps, like a gentle camp and aggressive camp or whatever you want to call it. And and politically it's split in half. And it happens with dog training too. So there's this deep hate for the dog whisperer.
So there's a faction of people out there that hate the dog whisperer.
Of dog trainers.
Uh-huh. Of dog trainers.
Yeah.
Dog people, maybe.
Yeah. And I'm going to go out not much on a limb and say, like, every single one of these trainers that I've seen say this, or at least 95% are women trainers. And they're like, he's being too rough and mean to the dogs. Mm-hmm. Like, he gives them little kicks. Like, I don't know if you, like, a little...
He like pokes him in the ribs or something, right?
Like with his foot.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
do like
his
a
heel.
Little back heel. To the, and they're like, they're just horrified by any
violence. They interpret that as abuse.
Sort. Yeah. And so he's hated by a lot of people out there as being too abusive. And he's used shock collars.
Okay.
Which again, so it sounds terrible.
Yeah.
Like a shock collar. Like if I heard it, I'm like, don't use a shock collar. But it's just the word. Like, have you felt a shock collar?
I might have.
I've shocked myself with a shock collar. It doesn't hurt that much.
Okay.
Is the facts of it. You know, it sounds like you're shocking the dog that's horrible, but like, doesn't really hurt that
much. You're not torturing the dog. Yeah.
It just startles. So again, you could use a shock collar in a horrible way or you could use it in an okay way. It's like everything. It has.
Right. And I imagine dogs in the wild and wolves, when they're communicating with each other, there's probably a little bit of biting going on. And it's not like they're not biting to kill, but they're probably biting to communicate and correct.
Yeah. That's why it's weird why you have to train that out of dogs, because it's normal for them to nip, especially like a kid bothering them. It's normal for them to send the message with a little bite. Like, don't do that.
Yeah.
So you run into trouble with that.
But most dogs seem to get out of that.
Yeah. Well, they better.
Yeah.
Especially if you have a big one. I noticed that all these people with little dogs, they have the luxury being like, oh, he bites. Like, I can't have that. If you have a 100-pound dog, they can't bite anybody.
I had a friend who had adopted this old dog, and it was tiny. I don't know if it was like a really miniature poodle, but very small dog. And it would just turn around and bite you for no provocation whatsoever. And it had like four teeth, but it kind of sucked. Yeah. And I didn't like being around it. Like, it would cuddle up against you. And then occasionally it would just bite you like a viper. And they were completely compassionate about the dog. And they go, he does that sometimes. And I'm like, yeah, well, that sucks. Yeah. I don't want to be around this thing.
One of my good friends in high school had a Doberman. So that's kind of a formidable dog. I think everyone knows what a Doberman is.
They are an impressive beast. Yeah. Right?
And this one was crazy. So my friend lived in a completely crazy house.
Yep.
And everyone was crazy. And so the dog was crazy.
Yeah. Oh, right.
So I remember, like, I pet the dog, play with the dog, get along with it. One time it literally went to sleep with its head on my lap.
Nice.
And then it wakes up and it just wakes up like immediately, like this, the worst growl right at me. And I'm like sitting back against something. I can't defend myself at all. Like, and the dog's head, it was on my lap. So it's like right here and just like
right near your genitals, bears
its teeth,
right?
And just like starts staring. It's like this. And I'm like, I can't move because I'm like sitting against something. And I'm like, hey, man, like get your dog. My friend's laughing, going, oh, yeah, he does that.
That's
so you just reminded me. I'm like, he does that. It's a big Doberman. And I'm like, he's going to bite me. And he's like, yeah.
That's
yeah, probably.
That reminds me of like when your wife has a dream where you do something that pisses her off and she wakes up and she's still mad at you, even though she knows it's a dream.
Yeah.
The dog had a dream where you did something bad to
her. I don't know what it was. I was just kind of backing up and trying to back away, trying to like scoot away. I was trying to convey, as you reminded me of the story of your friend's dog, where I was like, it's not like funny if this Doberman bites me. That's not like a little, like stitches in the hospital.
And I think people who aren't in the maybe above 50 or something don't realize, like, I grew up in Rosendale in the 70s. It was the Wild West of dogs. Like, there was no leash law, dog shit everywhere. Nobody picked up dog shit. It was just madness.
There was no such thing as scooping, right? Like when we were kids.
No, it was madness. And I learned a valuable lesson about sexuality, believe it or not, from dogs. I had this little dog, Tara. She was mixed breed.
I'm a little uncomfortable going into this.
Beautiful
dog. Just so you know.
She looked, she was all black with a little white on the tip of her long tail. Looked like a little fox-shaped dog. Beautiful dog. We're ignorant people. We knew nothing about it, so we didn't get her spayed right away. And she went into heat. And I knew nothing of this. I was a young kid. And one day I looked outside my house and there were six dogs sitting on our doorstep trying to get in our front door. And dogs I had never seen before in my life.
And you as a kid had no idea.
I'm like, what's going on, Mom? Why are all these dogs here? And it was madness. They must have come from miles away. Like, I never had seen these dogs before. Yeah. And then one of them, Dan, was a gigantic Doberman Pinscher. Yeah. I mean, gigantic. Black, ears cut, tail bobbed. And we had this little garage underneath our house. And there was a little peak of the garage roof that you could see when we had a sort of like a bay window, like a large window that looked out on the street. This dog jumped up onto the roof, that little roof of the garage, and was looking in the window. And I thought this thing is going to come crashing through the freaking window. And it wanted to, man.
Another
it was like
thing
breathing.
From the 70s was Dobermans were a thing. They did. Was the Omen.
Oh.
Were those Rottweilers? Well,
those are Rottweilers, Dan. Yeah, I was going to have to trump you there. Yeah, but Dobermans.
But they were like the scary dogs of the 70s.
They were. I think, who's the guy that was in Hawaii, the detective guy? What's his
Magnum
name?
Magnum P.I.?
They had Dobermans. Remember the English guy running the thing? He had two Dobermans that were the most perfectly trained assassins possible.
Yeah, I think some James Bond Dobermans popped up. And
they're pretty impressive
but
dogs.
But that is a funny thought that a lot of the people that may be listening are too young to remember was when dogs were just wild. Like people would just open their doors and there'd be neighborhood dogs.
Right.
Some would bite you and it would just be sort of like, no one would be
got bit all the time.
Yeah. No one would be like,
No lawsuits.
Hey, don't let your dog out because it bites. It would just be like, you have to watch out for that dog.
He bites.
He bites. Yeah. No one would go to the parents and be like, hey, your dog bites. You know, it would just be like.
No.
I had a friend that had a German Shepherd and I can't say it bit me, but like it would nip at me.
Right.
You know what I mean? And like, but that hurt. Like there'd be like little blood, like real, a mauling is a different thing.
Right.
But like, and even back then, I think a mauling people would respond to, but little bites.
I remember my friend Dennis Keating went in his house and he lived like in a three decker in the first floor. And I was sitting out on the back porch on the stairs waiting for him to come out. Probably was like 15 or 16. I don't know. And his sister let their insane German Shepherd out. And he mauled me. Yeah. He just started ripping and attacking me and everything. And I was like in a sleepy mood sitting there. And then they just pulled him off of me. And she yelled at him and swatted him or something. And then that was that. And like my arms are all bitten up and my neck was bitten. And that was that. And he came out and we just left and went and did our day.
What's funny about that, because I have a story, like I might have even told you this before, but that I didn't get bit up too badly, but I got chased down by a German Shepherd, but it bit at me, but it got the back of my coat, but I was a little kid.
Oh, right.
So it like threw me on the ground. It was dragging, like shaking me back and forth, thrashing me, and then they pulled it off. But the funny thing is about these stories, I run into from time to time to this day, I'm sure you have too, run into people that are like, I have some kind of phobia of dogs because I got bit like when I was a kid. And I'm like, well, I apparently got mauled at some point, but I don't really remember the story. Like, forget like being psychologically damaged. I don't even remember.
I don't even remember.
Like my parents are like, remember that German Shepherd mauled you? And I'm like, more I remember you telling me about it. I don't really remember it.
That's very funny.
You're saying you've been bitten a lot of times and there's no like phobia or, you know.
No, I love dogs, but I respect dogs. So if I don't know the dog, I'm not running over there and putting my face in its face, you know. I kind of do the ghost whisper, the dog whisperer thing where I just stand there and let them come over if they want to come over. But you know what I mean?
Yeah, you're supposed to.
Yeah, yeah.
So I used to have a very, very, very aggressive dog called a Tibetan Mastiff.
Right.
So everyone says they know about it, but they're thinking of an English Mastiff.
No, I know the Tibetan
Mastiff. Mastiff is a different thing. I don't think, unless maybe the breeding's changed, they should not be house pets.
Right.
They should be out in the
field. I've never seen one. In real life. I remember looking in the books and seeing. And in the books, they would say they're 300 pounds.
Yeah, they're not. They weren't that big.
Oh, okay.
But it was, yeah, I know. I saw books where they were like 220 plus.
Yeah.
You know, and I'd be like, no, they're not that big. But the, I was in Indiana, which we just talked about. And some breeder from Kentucky had Tibetan Mastiffs. And I was like, well, let's get a puppy. I'll be sure to train.
Cute puppy.
Yeah. I was like.
What was the coloring like?
Like black and tan, long fur.
Black and
though.
Tan. So they're almost like a St. Bernard kind of?
Yeah, but picture the coloring more like a Doberman.
Yeah.
If the tan was.
But the hair is more like
and
that.
Really long hair.
Really long hair.
Really long hair.
Okay.
Because they were very formidable. I mean, the real. Other than the pit bulls, anything that's a flock guard has to have the long hair.
Why is that,
like,
Dan?
So they don't get bit up by the wolves. When they're killing coyotes and wolves.
Huh. That so gives them protections, like armor.
Like even that, you know, that Rasta dog, the Commodore, it has like the long.
Oh, yeah.
Like that's, nothing can bite through that. Imagine trying to bite through that fur. That's
very
what it's
cool.
For. So, I got him as a puppy. So another thing a lot of people like to do is they get dogs not as puppies, as rescues. And then they like to sort of be like, any bad trait, they say, can you just imagine what he was been through before?
So they, this is really interesting to me, Dan. So they attribute bad traits to the nurturing of the environment, not to the nature of the animal.
Right.
Interesting.
And it's a excuse for anything, right? Because they're like, just think of what happened before I got in a sort of a blank area. They don't know what happened.
I was listening to a podcast, Dan, and this scientist was evolutionary biologist, I believe. And what they're saying is that there's certain human characteristics like intelligence and some other personality characteristics that are 50% genetic, can be traced to your genes, right?
Mm-hmm.
10% is attributed to environment. And they know this by twin studies. So identical twin studies. So you have genetically the same people, right? 40%. So 10 is environment. 50 is genetics. So what's the other 40%? I'll tell you what he says it is.
Am I supposed to guess? I can't even think.
Can't even guess.
What else is
there? I didn't know. Know what it is? Developmental. You know what that means? Is our brain starts as like one cell and two cells and three cells, and it builds itself up sort of like almost like foam building or something. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that if something happens in the environment where one cell is like 1 degree off in the beginning, you create significant differences.
So you're talking
ultimately
about in the womb.
They're saying, as the organism develops itself, and your brain's still developing as a kid, I guess, too, but the actual physical growth and development varies from one twin
to
another.
Right. Even identical twins in the womb, one's on the left and one's on the right. And so they're hearing different sounds and they're sort of not getting
into Yeah, there may be some hormonal things. Yeah. Or if you have whatever genetic plan you have, you could come up with something slightly different. So if we cloned you, Dan, the clones would all be slightly different from each other. And that's because of developmental processes. Like, you don't have a blueprint where you're putting every cell in place. It kind of starts and bubbles up from the beginning. So that causes – so they're saying that developmental process attributes to 40% of differences in certain characteristics. So that 90% of your – intelligence is basically not nurture. Only 10% is listening to Mozart when you're a kid and whatever, which is so I would assume that it's similar with animals too, I would think, right?
Yeah.
Like dogs, for instance.
Or maybe I don't know.
But if you traumatize an animal, obviously then you could have a bigger effect. Traumatize a person or a dog.
The thing that this Tibetan Mastiff I had, I know because I got him as a puppy. I know he had no anger
or trauma
in his life or trauma. And he was the most aggressive dog.
Yeah, of course.
Like he was so I also raised kids with him. So I'd always get this. People would always ask me like, how can you have a dog like that with your babies in the house? And I'd be like, he would never even growl at my kids.
Right.
He didn't have that in him. Like
so
they could jump on his head and he wouldn't do anything.
Shepherding dogs or guard dogs by history?
They're flock guards.
Flock guards.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they probably think your kids are part of the flock.
But they weren't even they weren't supposed to even answer to commands to shepherd.
Oh.
It was just go out and kill anything.
Kill some other canine.
If anything comes into this yard, kill it.
Yeah.
Was that how they're designed, right?
Yeah.
I'm suddenly having a flashback to mentioning this a year and a half ago on this podcast, because the other thing about the Tibetan Mastiff is they team them up. See if this sounds familiar with dogs called Lhasa Apsos.
You didn't say, I don't remember this, a Tibetan dog.
Yeah. They'd be
a very tiny dog, right?
Yeah. They'd be in Tibetan monasteries and the Lhasa Apso was bred to have great hearing and hair trigger. So the Lhasa Apso would hear something, start yipping,
and then this
beast would just be like, "What's this?" and go kill
whatever it is.
Yeah, whatever it was.
You didn't say that.
Yeah,
that's a pretty cool concept. Yeah,
except when you own one,
right?
It's a problem because other dog, my Bouvier, would bark at someone at the door, and I'd be like, "It's fine." He'd be like, "Okay." The Tibetan Mastiff would bark, and I'd be like, "It's okay," and he'd be like, "I didn't. If you could stay out of this, that'd be great." He'd just be like, "I didn't ask you."
He'd be like, "Stay in your lane, Dan."
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing is, a lot of dogs, I'm sure we all know lots of dogs that bark sort of angrily to threaten someone away. My Tibetan Mastiff wanted to get the person on the other side of the door.
Yeah.
He wasn't alerting anybody.
Right. He was chasing anything away.
Yeah, he was furious. He'd be biting the doorknob and biting the windowsill and clearly he wanted to get out.
That's scary, huh?
So it was sort of it was a problem. And then I'd be I tried to alpha him. I was a young guy. I'd be screaming at him and he was just I could not get through
that
dog.
So
I couldn't stop him.
Before I got the bloodhound.
Yeah.
The other dog that I looked at, I thought, this is a really cool looking dog because it looked like a everyday dog, a man's dog. Yeah. And then I didn't get it because it was a little bit like the Mastiff was an Anatolian Shepherd.
Yeah.
Same thing. We're just going to kill whatever comes in the yard. And I talked to the lady who had the dogs and she goes, "Yeah, you need about a 15-foot chain link fence around your yard." And I was like, "What?"
Yeah.
And
the other thing about those dogs is they run. Like they don't, they're not meant to like stay in a yard.
Or, right. Yeah.
They're not really meant to obey you either. Like I said, they don't like the herding dogs, like they're really good at listening to commands but these ones aren't bred to have any commands. You know, they're just, I wouldn't mess with the Anatolian Shepherd either. I'm sure there's sweet ones, like there's sweet Tibetan Mastiffs, but also mine was bred from Tibet. Like now most of them come through London or something, but like this was just some hillbilly in Kentucky had some Tibetan Mastiffs. Anyway, a dog episode.
We have a dog episode. I love dogs too. Yeah. I don't have one right now, but I do love dogs. Yeah.
Yeah.
So should we, I don't know, January 3rd. Should we talk about New Year's resolutions?
We should talk about New Year's resolutions.
Yeah.
Because that was right before the show, we were saying how we've changed our minds since a year ago. Last year, we were talking about resolutions, and I had a resolution.
What was your resolution?
I had a dry January.
Okay.
No alcohol whatsoever last January.
Yeah.
Now my mindset through a year of podcasting and talking about these issues, well, it depends. Like, it's too simple to say a resolution's good or bad. It's what is the nature of the resolution? How do you use a resolution? Like, it is the typical way people talk about it, I think, is worthless, right? It's sort of, they even know they're not going to, you hear people laughing and saying, oh, I'll go to the gym for the first 2 weeks and then it'll be gone. And that is worthless.
Mm.
Like a resolution that you know is not even going to produce results ahead of time.
I think it's probably worse than worthless, Dan, because you're telling yourself that you're full of shit. Like, you're telling yourself, I don't follow through with what I say I'm going to do, which is probably not good.
It sends yourself even a more negative message.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think, so here's what I like about New Year's. And the first part hasn't changed. One is looking back on the year before.
Mm.
And it is the only time I think it is not a bad time to feel some appreciation for things.
All right. I like what you're saying.
Because when else are you going to do it? You know, to look like it's a good stopping point to look back at the year and think about some good things, good friends, good family, achievements like you've had.
What did you
think? So, your job or even just your health, like whatever.
You know, I was talking to Maria Kiprios,
yes,
one of our coaches and competitors, Purple Belt, and I did this exact thing with her, Dan. Funny you should say that. We were in the sort of lobby of the academy, and this year went by so fast, Dan, I can't remember any of it. And I asked her, I said, Maria, go through with me. I go, you won the Pan Ams, the Absolute, and you just got a silver in the Worlds. That's amazing. I said, what else did you do? And she went through all her tournament experience for the year, and it was way more than I could have recalled. And it was essentially a story of struggle in the beginning of the year and then real achievement toward the middle to the end of the year. And when she laid it all out, it was really impressive. Like, she did some super fights. She did invitational tournaments. She really did amazing. And the last tournament she did, invitational thing, she did an Iron Woman tournament. These guys down in Connecticut, they did a really good job. The name escapes Indy Academy now, but they're nice, really good guys. And they ran a cool little tournament at their academy. And Maria ended up coming in second, but she had a great performance and she won two matches prior to that, looked fantastic. So just to go through the year like that, I said, wow, that is really awesome. And I told her, I said, you should give yourself a serious pat on the back, man. That is really awesome.
A good time to look back and just think about that. And what did you do it for yourself?
I've been doing it a lot just because I've been talking about everything. And I almost look at it for the last 18 months because that's when we started it. And 18 months is almost better than a year, I think, because it gives you a little bit more time to accomplish something. You know what I mean? So I feel like coming up with another sort of 18-month goal. You know what I mean? I don't know why 18 months is appealing to me right now, because a year is good, but it's still not a really long period of time. 2 years is almost too much to get your head around. 18 months, I could probably get a lot done in 18 months. So,
And are you thinking of a new goal yet? Are you?
I'm trying to figure it out because I feel like I need to do something besides competition because I feel like I've squeezed so much juice out of that.
Right. And you have the world
that orange.
Championship.
Yeah.
And it's also
and it was a lot of hard work.
So this is so New Year's. One is looking back and appreciating. Two is setting these goals, which are like resolutions, but not the sort of, you know, what we're talking about now is how do you set a resolution that's helpful as opposed to some garbage that's like, I'll do this for three weeks and then I'll quit. One would be an 18-month goal or like a major goal in your life. Like that, you know, that's very different than saying, I'm going to start going to the gym.
Well, you know, I was listening to a couple different people. There's this guy, James Clear, who wrote a really good book called Atomic Habits. If people don't have that, it's worthwhile to get that book or to follow him on social media too. He's really good. He actually sends out an email, Dan, every, I think, Thursday. And it's a very short email, but it's really good. And he has like three ideas, two quotes and one, I don't know, it's 3-2-1 or something, I forget, but it's very good. And I think I was talking to, I think I was listening to Scott Adams, that Dilbert guy, and his whole thing is systems are better than goals. Right. Think about systems, and it's the same thing as habits. It's like, how am I going to change my day-to-day life in order to, but you see, I think you need a goal where you're pointing these systems and these habits towards, right? Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense, right?
And this was the last, this is also what I was thinking about a realistic or a valuable New Year's resolution is this. And it's something we've talked about, different versions of this on this podcast, right? Which is not, I'm going to go to the gym loosely, or I need to lose weight, or I want to get stronger, or I want to get better at jiu-jitsu. It's what system do I put in place?
Mm.
You know, what do I put in place? So you want to get better at jiu-jitsu, what do you do?
Right.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
Like, you want to lose weight, what are you going to do? And then do it maybe, you know, forever. Like, do you know what I mean? That's the other thing. Like, think of what am I willing to do? If not forever,
this year, horizon.
The year. Like,
yeah.
Like, so for 2020, you want to get better at jiu-jitsu, what are you going to do? And it's, you can't just be like, I'm going to go more to the gym. Like, it has to be, I think, specific.
I think so.
And then that's all the stuff we, I know Rory doesn't want us to talk about the calendar anymore. So, but say you're like, I'm going to go to the jiu-jitsu gym more. It's not quite enough. Like, I think you need to put up something like a calendar and be like, I'm going
to
put
track
an extra every time I go.
So Dan, and
track it.
I purchased two new calendars. I got one on my office door and one on my bedroom door at home. And as I was putting up the new one, I was taking down 2019, and my son was sitting there. And we sort of reminisced, like you were saying, we went through the year. Oh, here's where we went to Rome, and here's where we went to the World Championships, and here's where we did this and that. And he was very kind to me. I was like, yeah, I had a pretty good 2019. And he said, Dad, you made 2019 your bitch. It's not politically correct, but it was nice of him to say that. Yeah,
I know. But it was real. You won a world championship. It's sort of 2020 is going to be hard to match it.
It's going to be hard to match it.
Think of something. You could be a movie.
Here's my 18-month goal, Dan.
Yeah.
I want to get a publishing contract for a book. So I don't want to self-publish a book. I want to somehow get some foolish publisher to pay me to write a book.
And do you get that before you write the book?
I think that's how it works, Dan. You come up with a book proposal. You write
a chapter. And then
I think that's what it is. And I think the reason why that's better than coming to them with a book is they want to give you guidance and input and direct how it's going to go so it'll sell better. So for what I know, that's the approach that could work. So I figure if I spend 18 months trying to make something like that happen, it's still a long shot, but it's not completely inconceivable, right? Right.
And worst case scenario, you still have a book written or something written. It's not sort of no downside.
And it's like this podcast. It's making our lives better. It's going to be about these ideas probably and things like this. So only something good could come from it, I imagine. Yeah. Which is another good way to form your goals. Create goals and processes where even if you don't hit the goal, your life is better because of it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't have New Year's resolution this year because I'm just sort of like kind of happy with what I was doing. You know what I mean? I'm like, let me just
get
under control.
Right?
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I think that's the other thing. So here's the flip side, another way of looking at it. You look back on the year, because someone listening might think this too. They're like, I didn't win world champ. My year sucked. You know what I mean? Like, so then what do you do? Like you look, I think, again, just analyze it. Like, what sucked about it? What can you change?
Dan, I have a theory. When do people make major change in their life, major changes in their day-to-day processes?
Well, my first thought is usually never is the
okay.
answer.
Okay.
And if they do, is I assume more what you're asking.
Yeah. When is it? Like it is rare.
Usually there's some sort of crisis or wake-up
right.
call, right?
Yeah. Right. Like they get dumped or yeah. they get divorced or something and they're like, oh my God, I got to change the way I'm operating. Or they get fired yeah. or like something like that happens where the environment is telling them, hey, you're not as good as you think you are. And now they're like, shoot, I have to regroup and get my shit together here.
Right.
So I think it is hard when life is good. You know what I mean? When everything is kind of working, you don't have that alarm going off to motivate you. So I was thinking that, you know, we're talking about processes, but if you have a goal that's exciting and compelling, it's almost like, for me, I think I need to balance, have an exciting goal with a realistic process. You know what I mean? An exciting but somewhat realistic goal with a doable process. And if I can find that balance, that's where it's going to work for me.
Right. And the caution is, too, is all the details of things you said. It has to be a somewhat realistic goal. Like, it can't be wild.
So.
And you should probably give some thought to, like, will it make you happy? Because I think sometimes people go wrong on that. You know, they're sort
Explain
of like, I need to
Dan.
Go to the gym. And, like, it's sort of something else is bought. Like their relationships keep failing. And they're like, I need to get in better shape or something. Mm. It's like, that's not why your relationships are failing. Mm. Or, you know what I mean? Or like,
yeah.
they just sort of aiming at the wrong goal. Like, it's sort
right.
of, I need to spend more time doing this or that. And it's like, that's not really the problem.
Well, that's another point, Dan. There's always trade-offs. Yeah. So if you're going to the gym, you're not doing something else.
Right.
So you're right that it may not be the right choice. Not everybody should be working out for hours every day. Who knows, right?
Yeah.
And I think people underestimate that if I'm going to choose to do something, I'm choosing not to do something else. I think a lot of us have a lot of empty space in our life anyways.
Yeah.
We're watching
usually the
TV
gym,
or
yeah,
something.
The gym can replace TV or,
yeah.
you know, lazing around. So usually you can do it, but again, sometimes, a lot of times I think people might lose some weight or get fit and be like, it didn't work. Like, I'm not so happy, or, you know.
Definitely.
Because of something else. Like, it's not fixing whatever's wrong. So it's some introspection. So again, that's another thing I think New Year's good for. Like a time to some introspection about what if your year wasn't happy, why? And can you fix it? And what can you do? But I also think there's some people, I don't know if you see this on Facebook, there's just some people that you can look back year after year. They're just the type of person that's always like, well, thank God that year's over. That was the worst year ever. And then like you say it every year, you know? Like, it's just, it's like, and then, I don't think you realize it's your attitude. Like, you know, you think every year is just disaster.
Yeah.
You know, either personally or like, and then if nothing goes wrong for them personally, they're like, oh, with this president or, you know, something like that. They just always think that it's the worst possible year.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, you've done this for 10 years. They've been very different years.
I think so. I think you're touching on something. I think there is a phenomenon that I've noticed recently that when things are pretty good, people will almost invent problems, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, life, the other thing is if you go a whole year, probably something not good happens. You know, it's hard to go a whole year. Yeah,
definitely.
And no one you know passes away and no one you know gets sick. And, you know, like that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
You know, so then do you dwell on that or?
Definitely. You know? Interesting. But what I do like, Dan, is I do feel like I'm a little out of sorts because, you know, I had this long-term goal of become a world champion and I had a process that I was following. And then there's a comfort in that. When you get in the process, even if you're not achieving your goal, it feels good to be following
right.
the process.
And can I just say another cool thing? Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's going to be a scar on your forehead. But that's sort of an added bonus,
right?
To be like, not only did you win a world championship, you have kind of this scar, like as like a permanent reminder.
Right.
You know
yeah.
what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Not only reminder for yourself, but like also people can see you and you can be like, I got this winning a world championship. Like, you know what I mean?
Right.
If they ask, how'd you get that scar?
It's like in the late 1800s.
Like you didn't even get it. Like
the guys that had the scar in their cheekbone from dueling with Epes, right?
That was right. A big but it's just perfect. Have. You got it while winning the world championship, right? Like it's, even if you got it one tournament earlier, you couldn't say
or in
got
training.
This. Yeah, in training. Right. Yeah. Right. You couldn't say that's when you won it. So it's perfect.
So right? Really? Yeah, you're right.
So you didn't see the upside of that scar.
Yeah. Yeah, somebody said that. They said, you might end up with the scar there. And I'm like, at this point, it's a drop in the ocean. Come on, will you?
Yeah, that's the other thing. It's kind of a harmless, good spot for a scar, right? Like,
right.
It's not like, right? I don't know.
Yeah. And I try to be a man's man anyways, right? So,
but back to your point that now you don't have that goal. Like, you got it, so you can need a new one.
Yeah.
So a book might be a cool one.
I think that might be cool.
It's tough. Writing a book, though, getting a book published.
I'm sure it's going to be really hard in a different way. But if I can find a process and then just do it, I'll probably find some satisfaction in that, you know.
We can talk more about it later. I think you got some good selling points, though. Not too many people have the world championship. You've got a few things going to help you catch someone's attention.
Right.
And you may be a movie star in the same
We got a lot going
year
on. Because we got a lot going on.
If people don't know that are listening, there's someone's doing a documentary about John's generally about your quest to become a world
in the
champion,
academy. Yeah.
But, or to we've run been, the academy
we've been
or whatever it is.
Filming it, I think, for like 3 years now. That's so funny. It's going to be one of those multi-decade movies eventually.
I know.
It's going to be
good.
Like when I'm on my deathbed, they will wrap it all up.
Yeah. They were like, you better either win that world. You need an ending, right? So it was like either you better win it or like maybe get a fatal.
Eaten by a grizzly bear or something. Yeah.
Something horrible happens to you would be another good ending.
I noticed that a lot of documentaries, something really bad happens or the subject of it becomes really the subject of ridicule.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean?
Well, that's not, you can't rule that out either.
We can't rule that out either. Yeah, they may just turn it all on me. I watched a good documentary on the plane about John DeLorean, the car maker. I think I already talked about that, but it's a crazy bastard.
You're right. That's another thing, everyone making fun of the subject.
So. Yeah, that's pretty typical.
But it's good that you won, because otherwise you might... Another thing you could do is just become like a complete homeless and... You know what I mean? It ends with you in an alleyway or something like that with a bottle of booze. And,
right.
And then that would be a good ending too.
Yeah, they could let a few years go by and film that, and I'm still tortured by losing. Yeah, that could have happened. But, so we get a lot going on. I don't know if I mentioned it. I went to train with crew Mark Delagrati at Sit Yat Tong after I came back from the World Championships. And he said, did I tell you this already?
I can't remember.
He's like, Delagrati, this is the best you've ever looked. He goes, you're literally better than you've ever been in your life. And he said, you got that world champion swagger. And I told my son this, and he just scoffed at me and said, Dad, you say that basically every other week, that you just had the best session you've ever had. But Mark is an amazing instructor, and he can bring out the best in you.
Many times,
And but there's something about that, Dan. I did feel better than ever. And I think that people, or at least I do, I think probably most of us do, we have a little bit of brakes on us, like something holding us back from the last 2% of what we might be able to express. So then when you have those moments where you're feeling really good about yourself and you just let those brakes go, you do fully express how good you can be.
Right, but it might be a lot more than 2% too, I think.
Some might be. It might
30%,
be.
30%, some people.
Maybe.
It varies from person to person, right? And I think a lot of the more successful people you see are people that sort of naturally have a swagger.
I think
you're
right.
Naturally just feel really good about themselves.
Like Conor McGregor or somebody like that,
perfect
right?
Perfect example, yeah. A lot of the guys in the UFC seem to have that sort of natural feeling that they're, champions before they're even champions.
It seems like it's a necessary component, right?
Yeah, but it's harder as you get older, too. Life beats you down, right? Like, I think a lot of people are swaggering around at 20 to 22, and just feeling like I'm king of the world at whatever you're doing.
Mm.
And then,
the guy Gordon Ryan, who's the top grappler on the planet, he's definitely got that same swagger. Yeah. He calls himself the king.
Yeah.
He walks kind of with his chest puffed out a little bit, which he should because he's amazing.
And all the major sports of NFL and NBA, and they're all told from when they're kids that they're kings of the world too. So they've got the swagger built in often because they've been, you know, they're
you must feel that you are, right? My son showed me a stat about the Patriots. So they're the team of the decade, obviously, the NFL. And their winning percentage, I don't want to overstate it, but it was well over 700%. It might have been 780% winning percentage or something then. I mean, it's crazy, right? Over the decade. The next team was maybe the Seahawks, and they were under 700%. So it's like they're so far and above better than everybody over an extended period of time. It's just really impressive and remarkable.
Well, the length of this run has been insane.
Yeah. And I attribute it to this concept that we're talking about here all the time about process and system, where they're not just trying to win it this year, like, oh, we're going to trade all our guys and get a draft pick. They're building a process to be successful year after year after year after year and in the long term. And I guess everyone else is trying to do it. I don't know, but they're doing it better.
I'm thinking about, as far as practical advice of build this process for yourself, one thing is it takes effort, right? It can be, you know what I mean? Like, you have to sit down and think. Like, it's easy to say, I'm going to go to the gym more. You can say that in 1 second. You know what I mean? Or like, I'm gonna lose weight. And
know what you have to do, Dan? You have to examine your failings and your losses. You got to say, shit, I didn't go to the gym at all this week. Why didn't I? Yeah. And I think a lot of people don't like to look at their short-term losses, and they just want to sweep them under the rug, right?
Right.
So they lose the value of learning from those things. That's where most of the learning's happening, right? Where something doesn't go quite right, and then you examine it. You know, you got to be introspective.
And do what people need even before that, and this is going to sound strange, but they need to really actually want to change something or get better at something.
Dan,
and
that is so good.
You know?
Yeah.
And it sounds like everyone you ask will go, well, yeah, I want to change that. But like, they don't. You
know, they don't. You're absolutely right. I think, you know, an evolutionary psychologist says people make a cost-benefit analysis and then behave. And it may not be on paper. It may not even be conscious, but unconsciously, that's what's happening. That's how their behavior results. They're like, well, I kind of want to lose some weight, but I really like eating all this pizza and cake. I kind of like that better than the cost of being overweight. So then that results in their behavior, you know?
Yeah. I had a friend, I learned this way back in college. I had a friend that smoked a lot, you know, all day, chain smoker or close to it.
Yep.
And he'd be like, I really want to quit. But then, you know, and I'd say, well, why are you lighting a cigarette? And he'd be sort of like, screw it. You know, I'd be like, well, I knew him well. I'd be like, you don't really
want to. So what
is
going
to.
Over there? Yeah. Like, so he
really
sort of wants
to quit. You sort of want to quit. You know, it's bad for you. You don't really want to quit.
He wants to smoke a little bit more than he doesn't want to smoke.
Yeah.
So part of him says, I don't want to do this anymore. But a greater part goes, we want to do this.
Right. And eventually he got older, really wanted to, and then he stopped. You know what I mean? Like, when he really wanted to stop, he stopped.
So how does a person get to that tipping point, Dan? It's basically information, right? Like, they somehow perceive the benefit greater than the cost, right? Or of switching, I mean. Because there's a cost to stopping bad habits and bad behavior. The cost is you don't get to eat that stuff. You don't get to smoke.
Yeah.
So there's definitely a cost. So at some point in their mind, the scales tip and it's worth doing.
Yeah.
Worth going through the pain of withdrawal. Yeah.
I think another common example is bad relationships, right? It's people that are like, because don't you, we all know someone, right, that it's like you're always dating bad people.
Interesting.
And they'll sort of, often in my experience, they'll sort of say, I know. But then they still do it. You know what I mean? And they don't even say, I should stop. Usually they're like, I know. I always date the worst guys or the worst women. But, you know, they almost say they're not going to stop. You know what I mean? It's like, well, then you're going to keep going. And then you have to reach that tipping point that you're talking about where they're like, I really need to date someone else. Like, I really, often it's a crisis of some sort, right? With health for the cigarettes or
it's a crisis.
In your relationship in a crisis. And you're like, I need to change who I'm dating, right? I need to really examine this.
I was talking to a guy who was an alcoholic drug addict and did it for years and years. And then he switched and he became completely sober. And I thought, how did you do that? That must have been really difficult. And what he essentially said was, I woke up and I realized that I was completely alone, and I had sort of burned through all of my relationships, and it just scared the shit out of me. And he changed. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what it's two, in a way, two steps, right? It's really wanting to.
Yeah.
And then you still have to figure out how to do it through some sort of process.
Process.
Because you can say, wait, I really want to stop this now, but not know how to do it, like have some trouble getting it done.
Yeah. Then you got to structure your environment to help you, your environment, physical environment, environment of people you're hanging out with and everything else to make it work. Like, so for my goal last year of the jiu-jitsu, it's so easy. I own a jiu-jitsu academy. My son is great at jiu-jitsu, so we would just go train twice a day most days. And he's getting better. I get better because he's getting better.
Right. But even that, you made up your calendar, right?
And
sort of pressured yourself into training more.
Yeah.
And made it very glaringly obvious when you skipped a day of training.
Yeah. Yeah. But the environment was optimal for sure.
And there's days. So again, so we're always on here saying like you won a world championship. I'm like, well, I lost 20 pounds and you lost 20. But like, to be clear, it's not always like that's what I was saying. The last 2 weeks, I'm like, Lord only knows how much weight I've put back on. And so the last 2 days I got back in the working out again, back to the gym, and it sucked, right? Like it hurt. I was like on the treadmill, like, ah, this is
now,
miserable.
Dan, did you
like,
find really... this? Here's my experience. So I went out, probably drank a little bit more than I should have, ate bad, like less than healthy food. What I found is there was less joy in doing that than I remember there used to be. And I felt uncomfortable. I'm like, I don't feel good. I kind of missed eating healthy and I missed being on track.
Well, for me, especially after a few days in, I get back to, but I think it was always like this where it's like, you're just munching down double stuffed Oreos, but you're not really like, this is so delicious.
You're not really enjoying it, right?
Like it's almost worth just being healthy 5 days a week just because you'll enjoy those 2 days.
Right.
The pizza at the end of the week tastes better to you than three pizzas during the week, like if you're doing it all the time. Do you know what I mean? Like,
I totally agree.
You enjoy it so much more.
Yeah.
So I want to get back to eating healthy just to enjoy the food.
Yeah.
Finally get to eat something.
I agree.
Eat some crap on the weekend. I'll be like, oh, this is really good.
Definitely.
Because you stop enjoying it. You're just munching it down.
And then when I am eating healthy, my body feels better. And I like that too. I just feel better.
Back to that.
Yeah. So I think we're almost at our hour here. So how should we summarize this other than dogs are awesome?
Yeah,
we love dogs.
Summary, yeah.
And then look back on the year, pat yourself on the back for all the victories that you had.
Yeah.
Find some new, very long-term or somewhat long-term goal to excite you, and then find a process and a system that's going to move you closer to that.
Make up your mind to get it done.
Yeah. Yeah, realize that.
You really want it.
Yeah. Because there's costs involved, and if you don't want it, you're not going to get it done. You got to get that cost-benefit analysis correct in order to get there. And that's it. So
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. We get some great listeners, and I hope we get more this year. And please rate and review this. Share it on Facebook or social media. Tell people about it. And we'll talk to you next week. Thanks, Dan.